This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with actor John C. Reilly. He co-stars as one of the doomed fishermen in the new film The Perfect Storm. He played a cop in the film Magnolia, which has just come out on video. Magnolia was written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. Reilly has starred in each of Anderson's movies. In Hard Eight, which co-starred Gwyneth Paltrow and Samuel Jackson, Reilly played a small-time Reno gambler. He played a coked-up porn star in Anderson's Boogie Nights. Earlier this year, Reilly co-starred with Philip Seymour Hoffman in an acclaimed off-Broadway production of Sam Shepard's play True West. Let's start with a scene from Magnolia with Reilly as police officer Jim Curring. He's checking out a reported disturbance.
Whoa. Every time I turn around, it's something else. Slow down.
You
can't just come
ma'am.
In here.
Door was open, ma'am.
Yeah,
I got a call.
You're not allowed to just
calm
come
down.
In.
Calm
I
down.
Am calm.
Okay, I got a call. To this apartment, report of a disturbance.
There's no disturbance.
Okay, I got a call of a disturbance. Your door was open, and I just want to see what's
yeah,
going
but
on.
But there's no disturbance.
Okay, well, then you got nothing to worry about.
You don't tell me. I know my rights. Just come right in. You can't
okay.
just...
All right, ma'am, you want to test me? All right? You want to tell me about the law book? We can do that. You push me far enough, I will take you to jail. Okay? Now calm yourself down.
I am calm.
No, you are not calm. You're screaming at me. You understand? Now, I get a call of a disturbance, and I'm going to check it out. That is what I'm going to do. Now, are you alone in here?
I ain't got to answer none of your questions.
No, you don't. But I'm going to ask you one more time. Are you alone in here?
What does it look like?
There's no one else in here?
You in here.
John C. Reilly, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. Good to be here.
How did your character come about? I know that you had shot videos based on the TV series Cops earlier
right.
with Paul Thomas Anderson. So what's the connection between those two?
Well, it was this summer when we were both kind of floundering and we were just going a little bit stir crazy. It was after we'd already shot Hard Eight, but Paul was having a lot of difficulty with the studio that paid for it. And they basically had taken the movie away from him for a short time. And it was before he got the money to do Boogie Nights, so we were just, I wasn't working, and he was going crazy because of the studio, and just out of my frustration, I had a beard, and I shaved off the beard, and I thought, what's the craziest thing I can do? And I grew this mustache, which I thought was really funny, and just one of these weird actor hair experiments that we all do. And Paul took one look at it, he's like, oh my God. We have to do our version of Cops. You know, I'm going to get you a uniform, and you're going to come over here, which is something we did actually pretty frequently, even before we did Hard Eight, was I would just hang out with him, and he would say, all right, just go, and he'd give me some topic or something, and I'd make up some character, and just to make each other laugh, basically. So he got me a cop uniform, and we started driving around the valley around his house. And we, for a while, it was just me doing these long monologues in the car, you know, a la Cops. Then eventually we were like, well, we got to get someone else involved here. So we'd call up actor friends like Philip Seymour Hoffman or Jennifer Jason Leigh or a few other people. And we'd call them on the cell phone and say, all right, we're going to be there in 10 minutes. Someone called the police because your music was up too loud. Just go with it when we get there. And they, you know, invariably say, what, Paul, what are you talking about? What, the cops, what? Just go with it. We'll be there in 10 minutes. And so Paul would then film me all driving all the way over. I'd be describing what the disturbance involved and, well, you know, where we were going and, you know, just like they do on Cops. And then I'd get out of the car and he'd follow me to the door. And then we'd just start these improvisations with whoever it was that we'd called. And it inevitably led to, you know, foot chases through backyards. You know, it's the funniest stuff on Cops that we found really entertaining, like falling over fences and dropping things and reaching in people's pockets saying, is anything going to stick me in here? Anything going to stick me? You know, for some reason, that became like a mantra during these improvisations. Anything going to stick me? Like, you know, it was purely for our own entertainment, though, these tapes we made. And then we kind of put them away, and then Boogie Nights kicked into high gear, and you know, Paul resolved all the issues with Hard Eight. And then I guess when Paul sat down to was looking for inspiration to write Magnolia, he liked that character so much that he just, I guess, looked at the tapes and took a lot of what I'd been making up in monologues and stuff and sort of synthesized it into the script. And he added a lot of things to it that weren't there in the original improvisations. Like, he just gave him a lot more spiritual depth and made him a little less goofy.
Even though your character was based on these videos that were based on cops that you improvised earlier on, did you feel that for this movie you had to put in more, you know, realism, and you had to like travel with real LAPD officers to see what the life was actually like?
Yeah, I did that. I did. Once I read the script, I realized like I have to really do justice to this man and this way of life, and so I went out with some local in North Hollywood where the story takes place. I went out with a couple police officers and rode with them. And I have to tell you, it really sobered me up. I mean, that first time, I remember the first call I went on with the police officer was a domestic disturbance in the Valley. And there was this 14-year-old girl who had an infant baby who she was accused by her mother of hitting the baby. And then she got into a fist fight with the mother. And here I was in the middle of it. I was just standing in these people's apartment with these police officers. And I immediately felt like I was going to start crying. As soon as I walked through the doorway, I just was overcome with emotion. And I just realized from that moment, like, this is not an easy life. These, you know, despite the bad rep that the LAPD has right now, this is still not an easy life. It's like the pressures of this job are just incredible. And part of that is echoed in one of those monologues I have in the car where I say, it's always bad news. It's never good news. No one ever calls you to say, you know, I don't say this next part in the movie, but no one ever calls to say, you know, come over and see our baby just took her first steps, or no, come over where you just made a great pie. You know, it's always some horrible situation that you have to deal with. And I really felt for those guys, you know, riding around in those cars, you don't get that. You know, I've always been paranoid of the police. You know, growing up in Chicago, my license plates were always expired, and I always had something going on that made me really afraid of the police, because you see that image of that car, that this authority figure, and you see the uniform and this, you know, these lights, and it's just this imposing facade. And then as soon as you get inside that car, not as a suspect, but as, you know, someone riding along with the police officer, you're struck by how vulnerable they are. I don't know. I was really moved by that way of life, and I wanted to do justice to what those guys go through as human beings every day, you know?
How did you meet Paul Thomas Anderson? You've been in each of his three movies, Hard Eight, Boogie Nights, and now Magnolia.
Well, Paul did a short called Cigarettes and Coffee that was at the Sundance Film Festival, and as a result of that short, they invited him to be part of this thing they have there in the summer called the New Filmmakers Workshop. And what it is it's sort of a mentor program for aspiring filmmakers. And you go there with a script that you'd like to work on, and they hire professional actors to do a few scenes with you, and you film them on video. And when they asked Paul who he wanted to play this part of John in Hard Eight, which is the script we're working on, my name was one of the first names they read, and he's like, that's it, that guy. You know, he was already practically like a stalker of mine at that point. And, you know, not many people are probably aware of this, but I'd done already a dozen movies before Hard Eight. So, you know.
But they weren't leading roles.
No, they're mostly supporting roles, and I was pretty known within the entertainment industry, you know, the casting directors and people like that. But I didn't have too many people who were aware of every single little thing I'd done and who could quote lines from movies that I was in. And Paul was that person, and I couldn't believe it. And then I read the script, and he's such a natural. I mean, I met him when he was, I think, 23 or 24 years old, and he was just writing this incredibly mature, well-written material. I mean, this for me, like the hallmark of a good script to me is how quickly I read it, and I just whipped through Hard Eight. I was just blown away, and I couldn't. Paul didn't have an agent. He didn't have any kind of. He was just this kid, like, oh, I'm trying to make this movie, and he was very good to me and Philip Baker Hall. I mean, once the script did get out after this New Filmmakers Workshop, a lot of people wanted to insert this movie star, that movie star, and, you know, his writing was recognized as very good, but Paul stuck by us. He insisted for years, literally. It took us a couple years to get Heart 8 made, and we really didn't get the money until Sam Jackson signed on to the project. You know, ironically enough, Gwyneth Paltrow was pretty much unknown at that point. So,
She plays the woman who becomes your wife in the film.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So let me play a scene from Heart 8, which was your first leading role and your first role in a Paul Thomas Anderson film. And you played a young man who's lost all of his money gambling, and you're really down on your luck. And you meet an older man named Sidney, who's played by Philip Baker Hall. And Sidney becomes your mentor and teaches you how to win in the casinos and how to get the house to give you all the freebies and amenities.
Right. I should note that Sidney was the original title of the movie. Mm-hmm. That the studio that paid for it forced Paul to change it to Heart 8.
Right.
Which I'm sure you'd want me to mention.
Well, here's a scene from early in the film where when you first met Sidney, and he's offering you advice, but all you care about is making back the money that you need.
I tell you what. You come with me back to Vegas. I'll loan you $50. I'll show you what you did wrong.
Why? What are you, man? You think you're St. Francis or something?
No, I don't think I'm St. Francis.
Look, are you looking for a fag? Because I'm not some boy hooker, if that's what you're after.
I'm not looking for a hooker, John. I'm offering you a ride. I'm offering to teach you something.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you something right now. I don't okay?
I understand that. And this is the last time I'll ask. You want my help?
I'll f*** you up if you f*** with me. I know three types of karate, okay? Jiu-jitsu, Aikido, and regular karate.
Okay.
All right. A, you give me a ride. 2, you give me $50. And C, I sit in the back. Believe me, if you pull anything, I will f*** you up.
I believe you.
I'm wondering what it was like to work opposite Philip Baker Hall. He's such an interesting kind of hard-boiled presence in this and has such an interesting voice, as do you. I'm always listening to voices as someone who works in radio.
Right.
But tell me a little bit about the chemistry between you and him and working opposite him.
Philip, he's just an incredible person. I mean, if you get a chance to speak with him someday, just get him to tell you a few stories about his own life, apart from his work as an actor. He's just had a really fascinating road. But I really can't. My best friend in real life is a man who's close to 60 years old. So I already had. I mean, Paul wrote this script, and it was almost like he had ESP or something. He couldn't have known these things about my personal life that resonated in the script. And so when I met Philip and we were working on this, I could relate to the friendship that they had in the movie and how they relied on each other and how much love there was between these two guys. And Philip is just such a solid presence. You know, and those many scenes in Heart 8 where my character's all over the place. There's that scene in the motel room where it was very emotional. It took us all night to shoot it, and I felt like I was at my wit's end, and I remember just with tears coming out of my eyes, turning to Philip at one point saying, "Can I do this again, Philip? Can I do it again?" "Yes, John, yes, absolutely, absolutely you can." And just him telling you that with that voice of his, it was just so reassuring. And like, you know, Paul has said this many times, but he's just this treasure. He's an American treasure. And how he got by all of us for so long without being recognized is incredible. But luckily now he's working like, I don't know, he's got some incredible number of movies coming out already.
My guest is actor John C. Reilly. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor John C. Reilly. He co-stars in The Perfect Storm and in the Paul Thomas Anderson films Magnolia, which just came out on video, Heart 8, and Boogie Nights. Let me play a scene from Boogie Nights. And in this, you play Reed Rothschild, the guy who becomes Dirk Diggler's best buddy when he enters the adult film world. And this is Dirk Diggler is the Mark Wahlberg character. So you're already in the adult film world when Mark Wahlberg enters the picture. And this is the scene where you first meet. It's poolside at Burt Reynolds' place, and you know Burt Reynolds plays the porn producer, and you're mixing drinks and
director. Burt's the director.
The director, I mean, yeah. And you're mixing drinks and asking friendly but competitive questions to Dirk Diggler.
Where do you work out?
Torrance, where I live.
Cool. Hey, you ever go to Vince's out here?
Oh, no. I would have seen you. I'm there every day. I've always wanted to work out at Vince's.
Cool, here. Taste that.
Oh, rock and roll.
Right? Hey, did you ever see that movie Star Wars?
Oh, about four times.
People tell me I look like Han Solo.
Really?
What do you bench?
You tell first.
I asked you first.
Same time.
Cool.
Are you ready?
Ready.
One, two, three. You didn't say anything.
Oh, neither did you.
Now, were you familiar with the adult film world when you made Boogie Nights?
Well, you know, I don't want to incriminate myself, but yeah, I was somewhat familiar with it. I certainly got a lot more familiar with it as a result of working on the movie.
Oh, that's great. It was like permission to watch all this stuff.
Exactly.
Otherwise, I feel really embarrassed.
Yeah, and I'm married, so it was like, this, honey, I have to do some research, you know. But it's funny, after a while, it's like, Paul and I both feel this way now. It's like, I don't need to see another porno movie in my life. It's like, after you go through that and you see the lives of people and what it's just kind of like it spoils it for you. You can see the fantasy that they're trying to create, and you can see right through it, and you can tell what's going on in the people's faces, and I don't know, it becomes this sort of sad charade.
Wait, was it ever uncomfortable on the set because of the nudity and sex scenes, even though these scenes were largely satires of pornography? Still, people had to, you know, do it without their clothes on and everything. So, yeah.
Well, they play as satires, but some of those scenes were just directly lifted from actual porn movies. But sorry, I lost the.
Oh,
question.
If it was ever embarrassing on the set because
embarrassing.
Of the nudity and sex.
Right. Well, you know, like after a while, it's
or
like,
uncomfortable. Maybe embarrassing is the wrong word.
Maybe at the beginning, I certainly had a lot of fears about it. You know, I was like, oh, I got to lose weight and get in shape and, you know, all this stuff. And so I did that, and I had all this, you know, I was all worked up about it. And then when you actually get in there, I mean, I was ready to do anything. I actually didn't have to fully expose myself, but I was completely ready and willing. Because after a while, you get, I quickly understood what it was like. Or what it must be like for people that work in the porn world is like once you know the cameraman and once you know the prop person and you spend a month or so with them and you know the other actors, you create this kind of insulated little family, and you don't, you know, it's not like being in public nude or something. It's very private, and you feel very safe, so you're willing to just do whatever it takes. So yeah, I was willing to do pretty much anything at that point.
Now, in Boogie Nights, you and Mark Wahlberg also make these kind of adult action films.
Right.
Under the names, the characters' names are Brock Landers and Chess Rockwell. You're Chess Rockwell.
Right. People still come up to me. Drunken men between the age of 25 and 40 still come up to me and go, "Chest, you rock!" Just hilarious.
Well, it must have been fun to do these mock adult action films in which you karate chop your opponents and high-five your partner.
Yeah.
And act kind of badly, like a lot of, you know, cheap amateurish movies.
That was really difficult, actually. I mean, I remember when we were doing the movie, I was just fascinated with Julianne Moore's technique for doing that dialogue. she just made it seem so vacant and so, I couldn't figure out what she was doing. And I used to ask her every day, like, listen, you have to tell me what's going through your head when you're doing that dialogue, because I have to do some of it. And she's like, well, I'll tell you, John, what I basically do is I just try to clear everything out of my mind except remembering the next words to say. Like, no kind of actor intention stuff, or no, you know, no, none of the normal kind of naturalistic acting things that we do. Just simply memorization and saying the words as simply and just remembering them, basically, was what she said. I thought that was brilliant.
So this was her approach to acting within the movies within the movie, when she's doing one of the porn right. films, and she's supposed to be a bad actress. Yeah, that's
exactly.
great.
Yeah, Mark Wahlberg and I had a great time doing those little action sequences.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Mark, it was like everything. The takes that exist in the movie are pretty much the only takes where Mark didn't break into laughter at some point. Because, you know, you're just walking together with these high-heeled shoes on, these leisure suits. It's just, it was a pretty
big... Platform shoes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, platforms. Yeah.
John C. Reilly stars in the new film The Perfect Storm and in Magnolia, which just came out on video. Our interview was recorded last winter. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor John C. Reilly. He co-stars in the new film The Perfect Storm, and he starred in Magnolia, which has just come out on video. Magnolia was written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, who also directed Reilly in the films Hard Eight and Boogie Nights. Tell us something about the neighborhood you grew up in and your family when you were growing up.
I grew up on the southwest side of Chicago in a neighborhood called Marquette Park, which it's very working class, sort of ethnic. You know, Chicago is made up of this sort of patchwork of ethnic neighborhoods, and the predominant ethnic groups when I lived there were Irish, Lithuanian, some Polish. And that's my background. My father is Irish-American, and my mother's Lithuanian-American, and I come from a family of six kids. And, yeah, I was sort of heading, you know, it was sort of, you either got out of my neighborhood or you became a juvenile delinquent. That was kind of the two paths you could take. And I was quickly heading down the juvenile delinquent path, you know, shoplifting and vandalizing and whatever, you know, you get into. It's just boredom, really. This is the reason kids get into that stuff, I think. But then I met this guy, this friend of mine named Jim Lampasona, who's just this crazy Italian kid who I met, who I thought was really funny. And one day I said, what are you doing after school? And he said, oh, I'm going over to the field house to go to drama. And I was like, what? I didn't even know what the word drama meant at that point. I think he said drama. We used to call it drama, actually. And I was like, what is that? And he said, oh, it's a class. You go and, you know, do play theater games and do plays. And you want to come? And I said, well, all right, sure. And I went by there one day, and, like, that was it. From then on, I was about 8 or 9 years old then. I've been acting ever since. And so I did plays at this field house across the street, or in the park across from my house. And then I did all kinds of musicals when I was in high school. I went to a boys' Catholic high school, and so I did musicals there. And then I also went over to the girls' Catholic high schools, who were always looking for male bodies to play the male roles in all these musicals they're doing. It was almost 100% musicals on where I lived. That's what people wanted to see. So I didn't really get into drama until I went to acting school for college.
Okay, were you Nathan Detroit or Skye Masterson in Guys and Dolls? Because I figured you had to do Guys and Dolls.
That is like the holy grail for me. that's the one musical that I haven't done, and
it's my favorite musical.
Oh. That I went to see that musical on Broadway for my bachelor party. That was my bachelor party.
Mm-hmm.
Me and my best friend went to see Guys and Dolls on Broadway with Peter Gallagher. Yeah, that's a fantastic musical. I would love to do that one sometime. I keep telling Paul, like, that's the next thing we should do, is a big musical. And he says, yeah, he gets into it sometimes, and then he hears that so-and-so is doing a musical. Like, I think Lars von Trier is doing a musical, and, you know, he's just sort of dancing around the concept. But I keep telling him, no, come on, big Busby Berkeley, like, you know, film musical.
Absolutely. So your first film role was Casualties of War. How did you get cast in a movie? Do you get the attention?
Well, actually, we've skipped an important chapter, which is after high school, I went to this conservatory of acting called the Goodman School of Drama, is what it was called at the time in Chicago. It's now called the Theater School at DePaul University. And it was like, 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, theater studies, period, like for 4 years, and that's all I did. And I had sort of this big breakthrough with acting. And that's when I really decided, like after about my third year there, I decided like, all right, this is going to be my life's vocation. This is what I'm going to do. Because I was never one of these kids who was like, oh, I want to be the world's greatest actor. You know, it was just always something that I found fun to do, and I just kept doing it. I was always trying to keep my other avenues open. But yeah, I met this guy, Patrick Murphy, who is still my best friend to this day. He was my first serious acting professor in school, and he got me involved in improvisation and a lot of my technique and a lot of the stuff that I do best now as a result of meeting Patrick Murphy.
So how did you do Casualties of War? How did you?
I got out of acting school and I got an agent in Chicago and I got into the theater scene a little bit. I did some work with Steppenwolf Theater and then did a little bit of work with a company called the Organic Theater Company in Chicago. And I sent off this videotape audition to Brian De Palma, who was casting Casualties of War at the time. And I was given this sort of day player role off the videotape. And at that point, I'd never left the Midwest. I'd never been on an airplane. I'd never been in a film. All these things were happening to me for the first time. So I got on this plane. It was just amazing. And I went to Thailand, where we're shooting Casualties of War, which is the opposite side of the earth from Chicago. It was as far away from home as I possibly could have been. And then there were some cast changes once I got over there. And I was given this sort of cameo part. And they said, go back to, you know, they bumped me up from this guy gets his arm blown off to this somewhat larger role, and they said the role doesn't film for a couple months, so go back to Chicago. And I stopped in Los Angeles on the way back because I'd met this girl in Thailand who I really liked and who I ended up marrying and I'm still married to today. But I stopped in L.A. to hang out with her, and one night I had this dream that my agent called and said, you have to go back to Thailand. You're having a different part in the movie. And sure enough, it was just one of those rare things that happens. I woke up that morning and the agent called and said, you have to go back to Thailand immediately. I went from Los Angeles to Miami to London to New Delhi to Bangkok, got off the plane at Bangkok, then took this little flight to the small island called Phuket. Then I was picked up at the airport without stopping, without sleeping, or I slept on the plane a little bit, but I didn't know what role they wanted me to play. And I still had not filmed anything in the movie yet. It was just rehearsal that I'd done previously. And so I got into the car, and here's this producer, Art Linson, who I to this day credit with giving me my break. He turns, you know, it's a classic Hollywood moment. He's got a cigar in his mouth. We're in this Jaguar. He turns around from the front seat and says, how you doing? You're the new Hatcher, which is like the fourth lead of the movie. And I couldn't believe it. It was this really surreal experience. So I said, where are we going? I'm kind of tired. Can I go to the hotel? And he's like, oh, no, we're going to the set. You're just going to talk to Brian for a little bit, and then we'll let you go home. So we get to the set. I go through makeup and hair, and I get the costume. And the next thing you know, I'm filming a scene for the first time in my life in this movie. It was just this incredible adventure. And that pretty much kicked off, you know, my entrance into the film world. And I haven't stopped working, luckily, since then.
Now, you shot another film in the jungle. You were in Terrence Malick's film, The Thin Red Line.
The Thin Red Line, many, many years later, yeah.
And I think you were supposed to be a pretty major part in it, but a lot of people got edited out, or
right.
had a lot of their parts edited out, and you were one of those people who were in the film a lot, for a lot shorter time than I think you ever expected. What was your reaction when you actually saw the cut and saw how little of your role was actually used?
I have to say, honestly, I was really disappointed. You know, I love Terry. Terry Malick is, I feel, is a genius. And you work with him, you realize you're spending time with someone who's a rare, rare person. And so I felt just very lucky to have spent those 5 months with him. But it was 5 months, and it was far away from home in Australia, and I missed my wife, and it was a really, really difficult experience. And I gave it was Terry Malick, so all of us were like giving our 110% every day, trying to just really, help him create something special. And then when he got back, and of course Terry then responded to that. He responded to how much people were giving him, and he would just film things, and he was always giving new scenes and writing things up. And he wrote, a few different new scenes for me right on the spot, and I was so flattered, and oh my God, this is amazing, And I got back, and I got this phone call from Terry before I actually saw the movie, and he said, John, I had a little trouble. I wish I could have made a 5-hour cut, but certain parts of the picture became like ice floes. They just separated from the main, and I had to pare it down, and I just wanted to let you know. He tried to warn me a little bit, but even that, I was pretty stunned. I still enjoyed the movie, and I still think it's a real masterpiece, and I'm really proud of it. And there's a scene in that movie that I think is some of my best work. The scene in this medical tent with Sean Penn, that it just, I could feel it that day, like this is something special and rare, and I'm really proud that scene stayed in the movie.
My guest is actor John C. Reilly. He's now co-starring in the film The Perfect Storm. He starred in Magnolia, which has just come out on video. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with actor John C. Reilly. He appears in the Paul Thomas Anderson film Magnolia, which just came out on video. I spoke with him in January after he completed filming The Perfect Storm, which is now in theaters. So tell us something about what the storm sequences were like.
Oh, my God. That movie just about killed me. I always say this, like, whenever I finish a hard job, I said, that was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I should just stop saying that, because they just keep getting harder and harder. But, the storm sequences, for the most part, the storm sequences were filmed on a soundstage in Burbank at Warner Brothers. And they created this, they dug this massive water tank, it's like 1.4 million gallons of water or something in it, with this enormous hydraulic gimbal that this, it was a 100,000-pound replica of a fishing boat on top of it. And it would move in all these different directions, and these huge, they look like elevator shafts, but they're filled with water, and then they pull out this hatch at the bottom, and these thousands of gallons of water come rushing out like a tidal wave and smack right into you, That and they had, they look like jet engines for fans. I mean, the things could literally blow you over.
Is it ever frustrating that so much of movies in which there are special effects are about the drama of the special effects as opposed to an opportunity for you to, really act a lot? I'm not saying one is exclusive of the other, but I'm sure when you're getting pelted with water, that
yeah.
A lot of the attention is being paid to the special effects.
Yeah, well, on those days, it's actually kind of, some days it's a relief. Some days you go into work and it's a relief that, I don't have to dig deep into my soul and cry and
right. And
think about things that really make me upset. Some days it's a relief, like, all I have to do is go, arg, and... take some water in the face. Sometimes that's a relief, and sometimes it gets tedious. But actually, The Perfect Storm, how I was saying before how you have to strike a balance and try to choose movies that, not only will pay you, but will also give you something to do. And that movie really, despite all the action sequences, it does have a lot of heart to it. And it's a true story of these guys that disappeared in the middle of the ocean, that were just real working-class guys who were trying to make a living catching swordfish, and they got caught in the worst storm in recorded weather. So in the story, my character has he's divorced from his wife, and he has a little boy, and so there's a lot of emotion going on. Every time he goes out to sea, it's a big deal. He misses his boy. And each person, Mark Wahlberg's character, who I'm reteamed with in this one, funny enough, we used to tease each other all the time where we're making it chest and Brock on the high seas. Come on, man, we got to catch some drug smugglers coming in the harbor. It was pretty funny, but we're very different in the movie. We almost wouldn't even recognize us.
You did an interview with Paul Thomas Anderson that was published in a movie magazine, and in that interview you described one of the movies you worked on earlier in your career, Days of Thunder, as representing in its own way the decadence of Hollywood at its most extreme.
Yeah, that was like the pinnacle of that 80s kind of, you know, Coke and champagne sort of. I mean, I was sort of a babe in the woods. It was like my third movie or something. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing, you know, like, you know, people, we were staying in some Ramada Inn in like North Carolina, and one of the producers had them tear out three walls to create this massive suite on the top of this Ramada Inn. It was like, what are you doing? We're in North Carolina. Who cares? We'll be gone in 2 weeks. But yeah, I don't know. It was sort of a little bit of a fall from grace for me to realize like just how crazy it could get. You know, I was coming from this actor's background, you know, it's all about the work, and suddenly it was a different animal. Those kind of movies are a whole different breed.
Did you want to experience more of that, or were you glad to go from there to, well, when I think of the contrast between, say, Hard Eight and Days of Thunder, Hard Eight is like a first film by an independent director, really low budget. This was long after you'd made Days of Thunder.
Well, the lesson that movie taught me was, no, I have to say, it didn't inspire me to want to do more movies like that, because ultimately, I enjoy acting, and in movies like that, you don't really get that much of an opportunity, especially if you're playing a supporting role. You don't get that much of an opportunity to act. And one of the reasons I took that movie was so that I could work with Robert Duvall. And instead of having this, I mean, I had a really wonderful personal interaction with Robert, and I spent a lot of time with him, and that was great. Getting to know him was wonderful, but what I was really looking forward to was our work together. And then when I realized, like, wait, he's just as miserable as I am, and neither of us are really getting to do what we do best. We're just kind of, you know, we're making a popcorn movie, which has value, and I love to go see movies. You know, I love to see movies like that, and you know, they have their place, but at this point, life's a little too short to spend that much of your time in service of something that you really truly don't have your heart in. But that said, it's still incredibly tempting. You're surrounded by it all the time. You know, it's like sometimes, like, I've turned down, I mean, I could have been a millionaire many, many times over by now from the money that gets offered from those movies. So, you know, it's this balance. It's this balancing act. You have to, you know, you do things like, you know, a play at the Actors Gang here in Los Angeles, you know, for a couple months, and then you have to make some money somehow for your family or whatever. So I think I've managed over the years, with a couple exceptions, I've managed to choose studio movies that have something to offer to me in them, you know, something that's going to challenge me and you know, allow me to do something new.
John C. Reilly, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
John C. Reilly recorded last winter after the release of Magnolia, which has just come out on video. Reilly is currently co-starring in the film The Perfect Storm. On Monday, we're going to continue our Monday encore presentations of our series on American popular song. Our show will be dedicated to the life and lyrics of Dorothy Fields. She co-wrote On the Sunny Side of the Street, The Way You Look Tonight, Don't Blame Me, I Can't Give You Anything But Love, I'm in the Mood for Love, and this song, which she wrote with Jerome Kern for the Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers film Swing Time.
A fun romance with no kisses, a fun romance, my friend. This is, we should be like a couple of hot tomatoes, but you're as cold as yesterday's mashed potatoes. A fun romance, you won't nestle, a fun romance, you won't wrestle. I've never mussed the crease in your blue serge pants, I never had the chance. This is a fine romance, a fine romance, my good fellow. You take romance, I'll take you're calmer than the seals in the Arctic Ocean. At least they flap their fins to express emotion. A fine romance with no quarrels, with no insults and all the morals. You're just as hard to land as the Ile de France. I never get the chance. This is a fine romance.
A fine romance with no kisses, a fine romance, my friend. This is true love, should have the thrills that a healthy crime has. We don't have half the thrills that the march of time has. A fine romance with no clinches, a fine romance with no pinches. You never give the orchids I send a glance. No, you like cactus plants. This is a fine romance.
Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers singing A Fine Romance, music by Jerome Kern, lyric by Dorothy Fields. Tune in Monday for our show about Fields, which will feature performances by singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist Dave Frischberg. Coming up, a review of the new film Girl on the Bridge. This is Fresh Air.